Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. It is 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. It's the 9th of April, and we're ready to go. So we have a panel. We have you. I think we have all the ingredients for a great program, so we'll get started. Here we go. Let me introduce everybody. Former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain was with us yesterday. He's with us today, and we couldn't be luckier. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you.
Very nice to have you with us. Oh, look who else is here. Vice President of Editorial Development for the New York Press Association, former longtime editor of the Daily Gazette, Judy Patrick joins us.
Howdy, howdy.
Nice to have you here, as always. And our Tuesday regular, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Joe.
Very nice to have you with us. Alan Shartok, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Joe. I was out late last night.
What's late?
Well, you know, if you get up at 3:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning, then you have to get to bed.
6:15, Joe.
You have to get to bed by 7.
Right.
Or 7:30.
Correct.
So 8 at the latest.
Were you watching the basketball game late?
No, are you kidding? No. I'm a short person, and I don't believe in that tall, geeky game. So I was out with our friends, and 10 o'clock I was in bed. 4 o'clock, I was up.
There you go.
It's a good 6 hours, right?
For 6 hours.
Except for the 2 hours in the middle when I was reading all my email and everything else.
Got to know how to use that spam filter to make your life easier.
You know, a friend just told me about this idea of you do it twice a day. What are the times, 4 and what?
Well, you could have it up, come in at noon and 4.
Noon and 4. And those are the times that you dedicate to your email.
Yes.
And that makes you a more productive person.
Well, with Alan, he'd look at it at noon and he'd still be going through it at 4.
Yes. It's unbelievable how much garbage comes in.
A lot of garbage.
I can't wait till somebody figures out this, you know, the phone spam. This is getting to be crazy. You tell me that politicians can't figure out how to end that nonsense? Chuck Schumer complains
Chuck
about
Schumer it. Would do it if he could.
Well, he complains about it. But there's got to be a way, right? There's got to be a federal law. There's got to be
technology.
There's got to be a law out there.
Yeah.
There are laws that prohibit those kinds of calls from solicitors who are not who are for profit essentially, but they can't enforce them very well because of technology. So technology has to catch up with the technology that works around the laws that prohibit it.
And there are all kinds of apps coming out, but I don't know.
Well, we'll wait. We'll see. We're ready for whatever happens.
Meanwhile, I have to take a call, Joe.
So. Yes, that's right. Let us, so for the next, 75 minutes or so, well, all right, 45 minutes for us, we'll be in here. The governor's on at 10 with Alan. So we have a lot to get to, so let's do it. I threw a lot of topics out as possibles this morning, so we'll try to get to as many as we can. First of all, we'll talk about the Trump purge. Set to force out more top Homeland Security officials. President Trump moved to clear out the senior ranks of the Department of Homeland Security on Monday, a day after forcing the resignation of its Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen as he accelerated a purge of the nation's immigration and security leadership. The White House announced the departure of Randolph Ailes. Is that correct? Anybody? Everybody think that's how
Tex,
it's pronounced?
You mean Tex?
No, his pronunciation.
Is
Ailes or Ailes.
Ailes, okay. It's A-L-L-E-S.
But is he Tex, the head of the?
I think he's the guy they call Tex.
Tech, yeah.
The director of the Secret Service, who had fallen out of favor with the president even before a security breach at his Mar-a-Lago club that the agency effectively blamed on Mr. Trump's employees. Government officials who asked not to be identified discussing personnel changes before they were announced said at least 2 to 4 more high-ranking figures affiliated with Ms. Nielsen were expected to leave soon. Hollowing out the top echelon of the department managing border security, presidential safety, counterterrorism, natural disasters, customs, and other matters.
Well, here is a president who's taking decisive action to address a serious problem, one that was partly created by the president. Or largely created by the president. He picked a lot of these people. And they were connected. Some of the key people were connected with John Kelly, his former chief of staff, and he fell out of favor. And now these people are out of favor.
Right. So they seem to have an allegiance to the Kelly way of doing things, and while even though Kelly
there is a Kelly way of doing things, then there's the other way, right?
Right. Well, and he was their protector in some ways, and now that he is gone, that has left as well. Alan?
Well, the one that really puzzled me was the security service, because he did say. And over and over again how wonderful they were and how they were doing a great job and how they were protecting him. I think this is a guy who wakes up in the morning and says, off with their heads. He doesn't always think it through. It shows tremendous amount of disloyalty on his part towards anybody who has worked for him. And it means that his standard is to keep everybody dancing on one toe, which is that it could be you next. I keep thinking of, I know this is not an appropriate, comparison, but I keep thinking of Stalin, because he did that all the time. You know, he would just, you never knew whether you're going to be murdered the next day. I think that is what this fellow is doing.
There are people, critics of the president, who say, why don't you just hurry up and just cut to the chase and make Stephen Miller the head of the department.
I think the brilliance of Stephen Miller is that he's way in the dark background, that he does not compete with the president for attention, public attention. And I think the president probably loves that.
But he seems to have his attention privately, in the sense of that he is believed to be the person who is calling a lot of the shots, at least on these latest employee removals.
Yeah, but don't you see that's the whole point? The whole point is he listens to him. But on the other hand,
he doesn't have to
compete with him.
Right.
I think it's a brilliant idea, because I think we should get these ideas out in the open, have him discuss what his philosophy is about immigration, and have the lawmakers in Congress get to grill him a little bit about it.
Oh, you mean Miller?
Miller, yeah. Make him a Homeland Security
director. He'll say
director.
No. This works for me, he'll say.
You know, but, you know, everybody eventually falls out of favor with the president. I mean, he's got to be the worst boss to work for forever. All these people have shown him loyalty. Even Kirstjen Nielsen was out there defending the separation of children from their parents.
Terrible.
Even though I think then in the background she knew that this was illegal and she was not a supporter of it, but she was out there defending it, and then he cuts her off at the knees, like he's cut a lot of people off at the knees.
I mean, the one thing that is, if anything is surprising, that Stephen Miller, of American Carnage fame, has lasted as long as he has. And to Alan's point of by staying in the shadows, JP.
Well, I saw these firings as a sign that Trump is nervous about his reelection. I think that he looks at the numbers. Like the New York Times had this headline. New York Times, not Fox News or Breitbart, said border at quote breaking point is more than 76,000 unauthorized migrants cross in a month. The crossings, I think this month were at an 11-year high. There are now 50,000 migrants in detention centers. And Trump, if he wants to have a prayer at being reelected, he needs to deliver to, his base and to people that there are less illegal immigrants coming in now than there were before. If he's debating the Democrat on stage trying to get reelected, and the Democrat can say, Mr. President, illegal crossings have increased under your tenure as compared to Obama. He's in a difficult situation, so he needs to have a more, if he wants to get reelected, he needs to have a more aggressive approach.
Well, it's also a failure of the administrations and the Congress before he was in office for not coming up with a more workable immigration policy. And we came close to that in 2014 when we had the Gang of Eight. And those were people from both sides in the Senate who had agreed on an immigration reform. And then the Tea Party sunk that. And it by not dealing with the problems earlier, it created the current problems and the remedy. I mean, it's complicated. This is a really complicated problem. I don't think there's a simple solution, and acting decisive by canning everybody who has anything to do with it and putting in more harsher people who are going to take more definitive action.
That won't work.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, our host at this very nice dinner party we went to last night thought that who's had a big background in business, thinks that the, I don't want to misquote him, but that what's going on with the economy is what will save Trump. That the economy is so strong and so good that most Americans will have some sympathy for that, as opposed to all our attention being given to the immigration crisis.
You know, if anything, at this point, most Americans will look at what's happening at the border and think that the administration is failing. He's pointing out, he's highlighting this problem, in a way that wouldn't normally be done. I think that it's an issue, but to make it the top headline in every newspaper and every newscast, I think he's driving that, and the people are seeing that, you know, this is a problem at the border. They're not doing much to resolve the root cause, which is going back into these countries and giving the people who live there a reason to stay. I mean, nobody really likes to leave their home.
He ain't going to do that, Judy.
No, he's done the opposite. He's cut funding to these programs that help improve life in these countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, from where most of these immigrants are coming.
When we talk about where this goes from here, we are, as I indicated in reading the article, there are more firings. I guess that's the word, right? Firings.
Yeah. More heads are going to roll.
More heads are going to roll, and then you'll have more people who are coming in on a interim basis.
Yeah, and it's as I've said a lot of times, it's really hard for Trump to attract quality people. It was hard for him to attract quality people when he first started his presidency. And now, after people see what happens if you work for this guy for 6 months, a year, the best thing that can happen is you get fired or resign. The worst thing that can happen is you end up in jail. So it's going to be really hard for him to attract quality people in these very important positions that, as you said, Joe, you know, these are the people that are in charge with protecting our country at all levels.
So meanwhile, there's a great story in the – I just thought it was a cool story. It's in the Washington Post this morning about this the standoff, if you will, between Jerry Nadler and Donald Trump. And what the Post did was go back to the fight that these two guys have had going back into the 70s. So Jerry Nadler, of course, or as he referred to him, Fat Jerry, called the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. He is of course leading an extensive investigation into his presidency, and they look to be foes now, but they certainly have been foes for a long time. It began in the 80s when Nadler was a New York State Assemblyman and later Congressman, proved to be a major obstacle to a vast development project that Trump envisioned for Manhattan's West Side, which was Nadler's turf. Jerry was on him from day one, said Linda Rosenthal, a former Nadler aide who later won his state assembly seat. He keenly understood that this was a man who would try to get the government to pay for all his mostly bollocks attempts at development. His casinos failed. He lost money on deals. He left the banks on the hook for his bad financial plans. He was just such a braggart and such an insincere person, but Jerry saw right through that. Trump never forgave Nadler, and privately he has simmered about the chairman and his investigation, calling him an irritant who has long been out to get him and recounting their New York run-ins to aides. He was alarmed by the chairman's early March demands to 81 of Trump's close associates and business partners for a range of documents, including material on Russia's election interference and the president's finances. Nothing like a good old-fashioned grudge.
Well, I've known Nadler and about Nadler for years as a West Sider and watched him, and I can tell you he is single-minded in acquiring and maintaining power, and he has done exactly that here. This is a guy who is not going to back off unless, of course, you know, other conditions prevail, meaning blackmail or things like that.
You know, in some respects, this speaks to how Trump transacts his business, because really carrying a grudge ultimately won't do him any good. It's better if you're a great deal maker, you eliminate those grudges and you get the guy who's against you on your side somehow. And he apparently does not work that way.
That is so foo-foo of you,
Judy.
You know, I mean, that's very nice, and I agree, but I think Trump needs to have enemies. I think the idea of having perpetual enemies and calling him Fat Jerry, and by the way, he's not. He had the banding and whatever else, you know, you need to do for that. He's a small part of him, his former self. I think he needs Nadler, and he likes having that kind of an enemy.
Isn't there a Godfather quote, though, to keep your enemies close?
And keep your friends close, your enemies closer, isn't that it?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
I want to read one paragraph from this article just because I love it. So Trump was trying to get this project through, and he invited Nadler to see models of his towers that would rise above the city. When Nadler inquired about the purpose of the soaring skyscraper, Trump said he wasn't sure. But he knew he wanted to live in the penthouse, so high in the sky that he would have to call the concierge to find out what the weather was below.
He wanted to build a 150-story skyscraper and then have these other 75-story, six other buildings around it on the west side. And that would have required enormous amounts of public money. They wanted to redo the West Side Highway, and he wanted the state
what
to
West Side Highway?
Well, Westway, remember that? No, the existing Henry Hudson Parkway as it goes by the west side. He wanted to reroute that so they could have access to the waterfront. I mean, it's unbelievable.
And so they asked Jerry Nadler after seeing this what he thought of it, and his word was, "I find it grotesque."
Yeah. Well, he wanted the money to go for to sustain middle-class transportation, rail traffic, and do other things that wouldn't make the neighborhood too expensive for the people that live there. Gosh.
Right.
Wow.
The story also made mention of the fact that Nadler reached out to the HUD secretary at the time, Andrew Cuomo, to make the point that not a lot of the units were going to be affordable housing, and therefore it shouldn't be eligible for federal funding.
As the world turns, so too. These
are
the days of our
story.
Lives. Yeah. It really is.
And they use an archival photo of a young Donnie Trump.
But we'll take a quick break. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, Judy Patrick, and J.P. Miller. I'm Joe Donahue. Coming up at 10 o'clock this morning, Governor Cuomo will be on with Alan. We have many more stories to get to and some letters first, and we'll go with the letters and then we'll move on to other stuff.
We will. I just want to say, Joe, we invite you, if you've never written a letter, we really want you. It's great to hear from, you know, many of the people who are very assiduous about contacting us every day, and I love that. But the most important thing is, if you've never written a letter, come on, get off your duff and write one, and send it to us at how would you do it, Joe?
Panel@WAMC.org.
Right. Okay, so here we go. Mark says, the Democrats and all the left, including you guys, have been saying for months that there is no crisis at the southern border. Mm-hmm. It's all made up by the president. Now the illegal crossings vastly increasing and no common sense immigration policy. It's a crisis. Imagine that. The American people are not stupid. We hold Congress responsible. They are the lawmakers in the country, not the president. Anybody? Well, I would like to just say about that, for whatever it's worth, it is the president who is driving this train. And he has made it clear that this is his signature issue, and he's making – and I think an argument could be made that the reason we're having this incredible deluge of people coming in now is they have looked at the president in the eye, they've seen he doesn't have the horses, and now he is responsible for the increase in the numbers that are coming here. Because, you know, up to now there's been a semblance of order. But now they think, hey, he's losing this fight, and we're coming over.
We're getting in while we can,
right.
Perhaps.
I suspect that's true. But thank you, Mark, for that. And then Jamie says, acting like they care. Now Trump can appoint more acting directors and assistant directors who, pending Senate approval that will never come, will be totally off on the hook, beholden to Trump. He believes the word acting means they act like him. And when it comes to Stephen Miller, that's Trump on steroids. But fear not, like a fish out of water, they will all find they regret taking the hook and will all be out of our lives as soon as Trump is. I fear how long that soon may take. That last sentence is something I truly believe in. I fear how long that soon may take. Right now, you got an economy that's booming. You got a president who is bloviating. Is that the right word? There are many political analysts who think that if he plays his cards correctly, he will win the next election.
Well, there's two elements of it. One is the economy. It's the economy, stupid kind of thing, like Bill Clinton said. And if the economy is not doing badly, people will love that. But the other is that you scare them, too. And I think the border issue is frightening people. They think that immigrants are going to come and rape them and take their jobs and ruin their lives. And that's all been promulgated by Trump from the day one when he first announced his candidacy.
Do you really believe people think that?
I heard an interview on NPR where somebody in a rural area of Minnesota thought they were going to have their house broken into by Mexican immigrants because they'd heard it on the news so much.
There was also a piece.
Fox News, probably.
Yes. There was also a piece yesterday that was one in the, I think, in the Post, and there was also a similar story on NPR about how this issue could possibly backfire on the president as well as far as the concerns about the border, because basically he was, as you say, Mike, he's been on this since he started running for president in 2015. Well, nothing has really happened. In fact, the problem has gotten progressively worse. So does that then backfire and say, well, the thing that you were supposed to correct, you had 4 years to do so, and you didn't correct it?
Well, I'll give you another opinion on that. He saw it as a crisis. It's gotten worse. I was correct in identifying it as a major crisis. And I've tried to make changes, and Congress won't let me build a wall, and they're cutting me everywhere I go. And I'm fighting for you to protect you, you white Americans.
Yeah, and I think that how it will play out in 2020, the big determining factor is
for you, Mike.
Who will be Trump's opponent. If that opponent is saying, in fact, we're okay taking down portions of the wall. You know, I think Kirsten Gillibrand said we'd be okay taking down portions of the wall. Whether that person is saying it's not a crisis, we have to have a more thoughtful approach on this, or whether he gets an opponent, someone that's more moderate, who says we're going to be tough on the border. We're going to be even tougher than you, Mr. Trump.
All right, let's go back to the letters.
I just wanted to mention there's a very alarming story in the Berkshire Eagle this morning about a tiny little horse, you know, one of those toy horses, being killed by a bear. Don't you see the analogy between what we've been talking about? No, you don't. I can see a very puzzled look fleeting around the room. Right. Okay, so here we go from Bill. The majority of crossings are refugees, falling into the talking points being promoted in not progressive thinking. I think that this is supposed to read is not progressive thinking. And that's from Bill in Washington, Massachusetts.
All right.
Think about go that ahead. Horse.
Let's see. We have 20 minutes. A couple stories I want to get to. Let's go to Georgia. We'll go to the state of Georgia. The waning hours of the Georgia legislative session between votes on sex trafficking and organ procurement. Republican House Representative and lawyer Andy Welch introduced the Ethics in Journalism Act. It was co-sponsored by five other Republican lawmakers. The bill would authorize a board to create new ethical standards that govern journalists' work and to sanction journalists who violate them. The Journalism Ethics Board, described in the bill as an independent body, would be based at the University of Georgia's Grady College of Journalism. The university system of Georgia's chancellor would select 9 journalists to appoint the board, 3 editors, 3, quote, news producers, a retired journalism professor, and 2 digital journalists. While not expressly required to do anything, the board could promulgate canons of ethics for journalism, develop a voluntary accreditation process for journalists, and handle Georgia residents' complaints of ethics violations against journalists working in the state. The bill would also, and this is the big one, the bill would also grant interview subjects the right to request any photographs, audio, and video recordings taken by a journalist free of charge and at any time in the reporting process. Reporters that fail to respond in a timely manner would face civil penalties. Richard Griffiths, who is a was a retired CNN vice president and a former Grady College fellow who now heads the Georgia First Amendment Foundation, said he thought the bill was an April Fool's joke. And stunningly, it's not.
That sums it up well.
And by the way, these councils or other groups have been tried before. They don't work. You know, it's a, but it's a grandstand play by somebody who's been probably hurt by the press. Could you do me a favor, Joe, and forward that to Rex Smith at TimesUnion.com for the show?
You know, first of all, we have a code of ethics in the journalism business. It's promulgated by the, you know, Society for Professional Journalists. Every shop, every newsroom has its own set of ethics. So the ethics are established. They're there. Second, we need an independent press is fundamental to our democracy. You start messing with the independence of the press by subjecting it to government oversight, you might as well not you don't have an independent press at that point.
Yes, it's not the government's role to regulate the press. That is so contrary to the First Amendment. And this is an attempt to do that.
And in fact, it's one of the things that scares me the most about the relationship between public radio stations and the government. Because sooner or later, if they give you money, there's going to be some attempt at taking it away unless you come to heel. And we have seen that again and again. In this budget, for example, the president's people have taken out the Corporation for Public Broadcasting money. It is just a part of who politicians are and what they do.
And if you really want to put the nail in the coffin of local journalism, make them spend all their time giving copies of whatever they do to their sources, to the people they interview. They'll spend so much time doing that they will not be able to pursue stories.
That would be challenged in court if that were ever to happen, and it would, I think, even a reasonable court would interpret that as being harassment and being contrary to the copyright and possession of information. I mean,
who knows what's happening with the courts nowadays with the appointment?
No, it's frightening. I mean, there's no exam to be a journalist that you have to take, no license that you get granted. You have no other rights than any other citizen has under the First Amendment. And I think people think otherwise, and it's just not true. We're all protected by the First Amendment, every one of us. And if you want to, in the old days, if you had a lot of money, you could print a newspaper and you could say anything you want. Nowadays, you can go on a blog for free and say anything you want. And your credibility will depend on how well you document what you're saying. And your peers and your audience will determine your success or failure.
And we have to live with the bad ones. I mean, look, the New York Post makes it up. Fox often makes it up, as far as I'm concerned. So what we have to do is we have to learn to live with it. It's too bad. It's just one more set of words that are out there.
Can I also make the point that Georgia does not have a great series of freedom of information laws, so their citizens do not get the benefit of open government to the extent that they should?
Let's take a break. Did you want to say something, Mike?
No, I'm just saying I'll be interested to hear the media project next week.
All right. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a couple more stories to digest, and then the governor coming up at 10 o'clock. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. J.P. Miller is here. Judy Patrick, Mike Spain, Alan Chartok has letters. We'll go there.
Okay, Eric writes us, and a good letter it is. Letter to the roundtable, the president's mocking disparagement of political opponents on the basis of their physical appearance only highlights the fact that Trump is himself a small man, certainly not in the usual sense of his stature or his physique, but in the more significant sense of his character. And the letter goes on to make many other good points, but a little long. Okay, so Keith says, unfilled positions in the DHS, Department of Homeland Security. 9 out of the top 18 positions at DHS are empty. You can't run an effective organization with half of the management missing. In 2016-17, we were at a 50-year low on border crossings, and since then, Trump and his DHS have separated families, locked children in cages, and migrant crossings have increased. And that's from Keith. And Chuck says, the administration's approach to problem solving seems to be all stick and no carrot. Whether it's negotiating legislation, trade agreements, border security, etc., the exception seems to be Russia and North Korea. It seems clear that after 2 years that this is just not effective in any of the areas he does this in. And that's Chuck from Latham, where everybody goes around in circles. And Nick says, dear panel, doesn't the separation of families at the border constitute a crime against humanity as defined by international law? Also, just a thought. Walls not only keep people out, it also keeps people in. And that's from Nick in South Egremont. And Lee says, the left didn't say no crisis at the border. It's a humanitarian crisis, not a terrorism crisis or a drug crisis or any other type of crisis, to be dealt with humanely. And that's from Lee in Germantown. And Daniel says, immigration. Dear panel, what's the immigration crisis, in quotes? Let them in. End of crisis. Daniel in Brooklyn.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Moving on to other topics, let's talk about the Israeli election, which takes place today in Trump. Netanyahu sees an ally who helps him push the envelope. But what will happen today? From recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights to moving the United States Embassy to Jerusalem, Mr. Trump has given Mr. Netanyahu the political cover and legal legitimacy to embrace a position that critics say would all but extinguish the dream of a viable Palestinian state. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's vow for Israel to annex part of the West Bank would flout four decades of American policy under both Republican and Democratic presidents, but nothing emboldened Mr. Netanyahu to take such a risk more than the support of his ally, President Donald Trump. All this happens as the Israeli elections go on, and what will happen as we go? The president is being called Netanyahu's biggest enabler. And so now we wonder what happens as a result of the election.
So I have a prediction. I'm not happy about my own prediction, but I think Netanyahu's going to win. I think the coalition of right-wing parties, we see the NPR report we heard talked about yesterday. Everybody's moving right in that country. More people are moving right. And I don't see it. It'll be a closer election than a lot of people had expected, but I do believe the corruption thing will hurt him a little bit and some of the other things that have been leveled against him. But if I had to make a guess, I was going to say Netanyahu would win.
We'll say that just in early what we have right now, I mean, obviously they're ahead of us and timeless, but percentage, voter turnout percentage, is coming in at about 35%.
How does the timing of this work? I mean, you will get results at the end of today or whatever,
right.
But then people will have to form coalitions.
That's
so
right.
It could be several days or weeks before we really know who will be in charge going forward?
Well, really, I suppose. But I think by the end of the day, you'll see how many parties got how many votes, and you'll see the potential for who's going to take the whole shebang.
I think the president, President Trump, helped. Another way that he helped was just yesterday the U.S. announced that it was going to recognize the or designate the Iranian Republican Guard as a terrorist organization, which, you know, must be
gift.
Very popular. Must be, yeah, just a
last-minute gift
to help
Netanyahu.
The Netanyahu. It seems like that to me. I mean, the timing is suspicious.
Yeah, and it's widely reported, Jared Kushner's close relationship with Netanyahu, that these announcements over the last weeks and months have been, I'm sure, designed to help him. And I'm not a student of Israeli politics, but from everything I read, it seems like Netanyahu is the favored person to win.
Now, isn't there a peace plan that is supposed to be unveiled fairly shortly? And what will that contain? And will the election change that dramatically?
Mm. Well, you know, my sense of it is you have to look at the rationale for electing a more moderate candidate. And I don't see what that is in this particular election. You're not living there. We're not living there. And if we were, we might say the ultimate protection is always the best protection. This is not Alan Shartok saying this is what I would do, because I think you have to roll the dice and take a chance on a two-state solution. Nevertheless, I don't think that the Arab leadership has distinguished itself by convincing anybody that if we do create a two-state solution, that one of those states, the Arab state, will be ruled in a democratic or peaceful fashion. And the Israelis certainly don't believe that.
You could say a lot. You could talk about this for a couple hours.
And as we mentioned yesterday, on top of all of this, there's the he could get indicted.
Right. There's a grand jury investigating Netanyahu.
For a long time.
And they say within months he may face indictment, and winning today might, or his success today would kind of bolster his ability to get through that.
Well, right. Or even pass a law that would prevent him from being indicted, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, the idea you can't indict a sitting head of state is interesting,
isn't it? It's
a novel one. Yeah.
Wow. All right, let's go. Final story, I think, anyway, depending on how much you want to get into this. But Felicity Huffman and 13 others pled guilty in the college admissions scandal yesterday. She laid out a list of her failings. Felicity Huffman did. She paid a college counselor $15,000 to arrange for cheating on her daughter's SAT test. And yes, it had backfired miserably, turning what Ms. Huffman said had been an effort to help her daughter into a betrayal of her. Ms. Huffman said, "I am ashamed," announcing that she will plead guilty to a federal crime. Part of a sweeping investigation of college admissions fraud unveiled last month by prosecutors in Boston. In a statement issued by Ms. Huffman, she said she wanted to apologize to her family, friends, and colleagues, and especially, she said, to the students who work hard every day to get into college, and to the parents who make tremendous sacrifices to support their children and do so honestly. She was one of 50 people charged in a sweeping investigation last month, and she was one of 14 people, her included, that decided to plead guilty yesterday in court.
So they had a dead to rights, number one. Number two, does it sound to you guys like the lawyer dictated every word of them?
No, I thought her publicist may have had a hand in that, too.
Yeah, I thought it was a great – I mean, it's, like,
it was a gracious comment.
It was a great comment. I thought the line there about the thing that will scar me for the rest of my life, or something I'm paraphrasing, but is the betrayal of my daughter.
Yeah.
Excellent. I mean, it's – what I wonder is, would anyone be less inclined to watch a movie? She's starring in a new movie about the Central Park Five, about the kids who were wrongfully sent to prison for the rape in Central Park. And she had a chief role in that movie. That's coming out soon. Would you not watch it because she's in it? I wonder how it's going to affect.
What would you
that.
Think, Mike? You think you people will just out of pure
Very
interest.
Interesting. Yeah. It's different than Lori Loughlin, who paid $500,000 to get her daughters into college.
And she hasn't pled, right?
And she hasn't pled, but it's going to put a lot of pressure on her. But
But the whole – I mean, there's I'm sorry to interrupt. There are two very separate ways that this has been dealt with. And I don't know. I think this goes a long way. You look at the Felicity Huffman approaches to put out a statement which is very, damning to herself and apologetic. And Lori Loughlin was signing autographs at the courthouse. It's just a little bit different of an approach, smiling it's
both effective.
Are they? I don't know.
Well, both protect their professional, perhaps, I guess, reputation.
And the thing is, people are going to go to jail here.
Oh.
Well, that's right. The charge.
She could be in jail.
Even the Felicity Huffman and most of the parents that pled guilty of. So they pled down, and it's to a single count. A single count of conspiracy to commit mail fraud and honest services mail fraud.
Still up to 20 years.
20 years. A maximum of 20 years. It's unclear how much time, if any, Ms. Huffman and the other parents will receive.
When the story first broke, eventually there was an honest discussion about the fundamental problems in our college admission process and how that needed to be rectified. This is more than about bribing someone to proctor a test and give people answers. This is about the fundamental unfairness in a lot of the processes. I am worried that the quick disposition of these cases, this is all going to get swept under the rug, and we're really not going to have a real change in how we treat admission to college.
I don't disagree with you, but also or could it be that they are trying to deal with the small fish and waiting for the real pounds to go in the larger fish, i.e. people who spent up to $500,000?
I think that we've seen a lot of investigations into the corruption of financial institutions and healthcare companies, and I think we will see a lot more investigations of the rife corruption on college campuses throughout the country. These are not-for-profit institutions where administrators make hundreds of thousands of dollars every year. These institutions are becoming more and more unpopular because of the cost of them. You know, people are putting
on spiraling costs. They go up every year, way beyond.
We're talking $60,000-$70,000
It's
to get your kid into college.
Right.
And by the way, we're talking about the 1% at the top of colleges, elite colleges in this country.
Well, Syracuse University, $72,000 to go to Syracuse, and the administrators make $400,000, $500,000, $600,000. Can you imagine what kind of lifestyle you can live in Syracuse, New York, making $600,000 or $700,000? That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, and I wonder how much that basketball coach gets paid as well.
Yes.
And one last thing, and that is you have the guy who set the whole thing up now willing to testify against everybody who gave him the money. So there really is no way out for any of them.
What I want to know is why Bill Macy, William H. Macy, Felicity Huffman's husband, hasn't been connected to this.
We can only assume that he wasn't on the tape, right? That they didn't have the...
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
People
all
love
right.
William H. Macy, too.
Well,
Fargo?
Yeah,
come on.
Yeah,
I'm going to watch
that
it.
We don't arrest people that we don't, just no, that we like. I mean, all right.
No shop there anymore.
I'm looking over at the phone, and the governor is on hold. So let us move on. My thanks to the entire panel. Mike Spain, Judy Patrick, and you don't have to, like, run out. That's all right.
Well, he's on hold.
We actually do have to run out.
All right. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable, and we welcome the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, speaking with WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Who's a gentleman? Thank you very much for your appearance here today, Governor. It's always great to see you. So I got a lot of questions for you. I was out late last night, and I'm a bear of a mood. I'll just ask you little simple questions, and then you can just answer them as only you can, okay?
That'd be fine.
All right, here we're going. You have talked about the budget. You got the analysis in the Times. You got pretty much everything you wanted. Speaker Hastie said that he wasn't happy with a lot of it. What do you make of that?
First, I'm going to let go the points you made that you were out last night and you're in a bad of a mood. Almost sounds like you imbibed too much, doctor. But let me ask.
No, I didn't eat anything. I sat there in a room full of people that were eating wonderful food, but I'm on a particular kind of diet where you can't eat. You can only eat for 8 hours a day, and my 8 hours had been long gone. So that's why I'm in a bad mood.
Was there any drinking involved, doctor?
Yes, they all drank, but not me. I don't drink. I don't do
not
that.
Not at all.
No.
Not one. Not a sip.
Okay. Not a sip, and I'm telling you. And the implication that I do is deeply resented by me.
No, well, first of all, there's nothing. I didn't say drink to excess. It was just that you have a drink, which is fine. People have a drink, and that's nice. And we enjoyed wine in my family. Moving right along, on the budget, I think the budget was fairly straightforward this year. Number one, we had a number of glaring policy areas that I pointed out very early on. You can call them lines in the sand, but I said as a matter of public responsibility, there were certain issues that we had to address. We had to do criminal justice reform. We had to fund mass transit. We had to address public finance. We had to make a property tax cap permanent. And then you had the numbers on the budget. And on the numbers, everybody wants more money. You had a new legislature, and they had made a lot of promises. And people in government, you want more money to do more good things. They believe, frankly, that more money is always synonymous with doing more good, which I don't believe it is. They leave out management. But then on the numbers, the Senate budget didn't raise any taxes. The Assembly budget did raise taxes. So the assembly budget, in truth, had more revenue to spend because they raised taxes. The Senate budget raised no new taxes. Why? Because, yes, they're a Democratic Senate, but they still represent moderate areas, and they want to get reelected. So you still have Long Island and Westchester and Hudson Valley and upstate where people don't want any additional taxes. So that was the constraint of the budget that, frankly, I think people missed. Once you have a Senate budget that raises no new taxes, it means you can't spend any more money, especially when we have a revenue shortfall. So that constrained the spending by definition.
And so that's why Hastie is ticked off? Because he didn't get to spend more money?
Speaker Hastie, by his own budget, raised taxes and had more revenue. Mm-hmm. So he legitimately can say, I proposed higher spending, which he did, because he proposed more taxes. The Senate said they supported higher spending, except they had no additional revenues. And at one point, its numbers and its math, and it's not political rhetoric, and they didn't support any more taxes. I actually supported more tax increases than the Senate did. We did a real estate transfer tax for mass transit funding. But that's what the budget came down to. You had policy items that I put a line in the sand, but if you asked any New Yorker, they would say those were the issues that had to be addressed. Then the assembly didn't spend the money that they wanted, but they were honest and they had actually raised revenues. And the Senate needs to maintain their majority, right? You have a Democratic Senate. What is success? First, basic functionality. Don't trip over your own feet. And second, they have to win the majority again next year. Mm-hmm. And to do that, they have to win those marginal seats. That's the bottom line. And the politics of New York City is different than the politics of upstate and Long Island, et cetera.
Good. Okay, moving right along, Governor, if you don't mind, I want to talk to you about there's a possibility. Alexandra Biaggi and others are threatening basically to run primaries against other Democrats. She won a primary, and is this a good idea, or is this a good example of a circular firing squad?
This is the proverbial circular firing squad. President Obama actually used that expression this past weekend. Yes. It's an oldie, but it's a goodie. Sort of like us, Doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
Boy, you are a bear today. But Nancy Pelosi is seeing it on the congressional side. We're seeing it here in the state. I think it is destructive. It's also an aberrational political moment. You normally don't have members attacking any members. I don't think it's productive. I think it's also dangerous. When a member attacks another member, you know, you better make sure you know what you're talking about. One of these attacks was about fundraising, but those members who made the attack did fundraising themselves during the budget. Andrea Stewart Cousins and Mike Gennaris were doing $25,000 fundraisers in the shadow of the Capitol in the middle of the budget. And that's just a collection agency for the individual senators, the DSCC.
Well, you were too, right, Governor? I mean, you had a $25,000 seat.
Yes. But I'm saying the hypocrisy is the members who stood up and criticized the fundraising. They themselves were doing fundraising, and Gennaris and Andrea Stewart Cousins' fundraising goes to those members, right? Because what they call the DSCC committee is just a collection agency, gives money to those members. And many of those members were funded with millions of dollars of dark money from unions like 32BJ. Where is the public financing spirit? You know, I support public financing. By the way, I was elected because an independent expenditure committee dumped $1 million into my race. So I think it is dangerous. And also, in this cycle, the circular firing squad, today's reformer is tomorrow's incumbent.
Yeah, we've seen that.
Tomorrow's establishment. Right. So when they go to run next year, there's going to be a new primary challenger who is going to hold them to the perfect standard. Why did you let 32BJ finance your campaign? Why didn't you condemn them? Why didn't you condemn Mike Gennaris? Why did you take his dirty money? You know, it all comes around. It's a boomerang. It's karma. And in this cycle, it is destructive because Speaker Pelosi is going through is Democrats attacking other Democrats for not being purist. And in this system, it is very, very hard to be a purist. And people are living in glass houses. So be careful how many stones you throw.
So where was Speaker Hastie during the debate over public financing of campaigns?
Public financing is less a question of do you support it, more a question of how do you do it. And it gets very complicated very quickly. And that's why we all supported it, putting it into a commission that could actually sit down and talk it through and figure it out. Not an independent commission. One of the editorial boards said you should appoint independent people. It's not independent. It's a process of the legislature. The commission then comes back, gives the legislature a bill. If they like it, it becomes law. If they don't like it, the legislature can pass a new law.
I'll believe it when I see it. You know, these guys in the assembly, specifically the Democrats, were all for it when the Republicans were running the Senate. But now that it has a chance of happening, we get commissions and reports and things of, that we are all too used to.
Look, the commission. No, hold on a second. The commissions.
What?
I'm sorry, you're in a bad mood. I am sorry, you are in a bad mood. And I feel it and I sense it, and I'm sure your listeners hear it. But I believe my role as governor is to take your negative emotion, absorb it, not respond to it, and attempt to turn it positive. I think that's one of my roles as governor. So the cynicism you just expressed about commissions, this is not a commission, give me a report and I'll put it on the shelf and I'll... this is give me a law.
We'll see.
And if nothing, okay, we'll see.
We'll just see about that. Now,
we'll just see.
You're backing an effort in Albany that would allow the State Department of Tax and Finance to release tax returns sought by Congress, namely President Trump's tax returns. Explain, will we get to see, if this happens on the state level, will we get to see the federal returns also as an appendage of this?
No. You could only see the state return. There are a variety of approaches, and I've talked about a couple of them, but it's an interesting topic. The one proposal is a House committee, which now does not have the ability to subpoena our State Department of Tax and Finance to get a state tax form, only a law enforcement agency can do that, and the House committee is not a law enforcement agent. They would have to go to a prosecutor. The prosecutor would have to do a subpoena. The point is to let the House committee get the state tax return Donald Trump files in the state. If you have the state tax return, you basically have a large window into the federal return because one plays off the other. The one proposal is House committee can be added to the list of state entities allowed to access the State Department, the State Department of Tax and Finance. And that's a political, obvious move, I think valid, but political. The question is going to be the legality, because there's going to be a lawsuit in 11 seconds. So, and putting on my old AG hat, if it looks politically targeted, the courts will be more likely to strike it down. So as broad as you can do it, the better. House committee for any elected official in the state of New York, you can get the tax returns.
And when you say House governor, you're talking about the Assembly.
I'm sorry. I'm talking about the Congressional House Committee.
Gotcha. Okay. So that
they want the Congressional House Committee to be able to get a state tax return.
Gotcha.
So the broadest and I think most legally defensible would be any request from a Congressional House Committee to the State Department of Tax and Finance, you can get the return of a New York State resident. Any elected official. I had proposed, and I think not only politically and legally better, but also governmentally better, why not say any elected official or any person who runs for office in the state of New York, your tax return will be released. Period. No hypocrisy, no duplicity, no political games. You're an assemblyman, you're a senator, you want the president's tax return, release your own.
Okay, fine.
But just think about this, Alan. We'd be the first in the nation. Anyone who runs for office or holds office, if you didn't want to say just candidate, I would say candidates. But even if you said only, once you hold office, you must release your tax returns. If you want Donald Trump's tax returns, why don't you release your own? And by the way, we now have a law in the state that says the legislature has no outside income, which makes it very simple. It means you only have one source of income on your tax return. It's called the state of New York. Why not release it? That's what I've proposed. I think it would set a heck of a precedent for the entire country. You want to talk about transparency and disclosure? You take office in the state of New York, you release your tax returns. Okay. And for every year you serve, you release your tax returns. And this Trump bill this year, on the theory before, be careful what you say, because it will boomerang. In next year's elections for the Assembly and the Senate, I'm sure they're going to say, you were right to ask for Trump's tax returns. I'm your primary opponent. Why didn't you release your own? What are you hiding?
So there have also been proposals that that the state legislature would pass a bill saying if you want to run for president in the United States, you have to release your tax returns. Where are you on that one?
I would support that, too. But again, it's going to be the political litmus test, and then it's going to be the legal litmus test. You know, if we have passed a law that is clearly designed to help a Democratic Congress access Donald Trump's tax return, it'll be in the courts for years, because this really does raise serious constitutional questions. So the broader you make it, the better. Just this, Alan, if you want to be on a ballot in New York State, you must release your tax returns.
Okay, that's good.
Period.
Listen, I have 1,000 questions for you, Governor. I only got 13 minutes to ask them in. So let's just move it right along. Is that okay with you?
Whatever you say, it's your show. I respect you.
No,
you're the boss.
I'm just
a public servant.
I don't think so. Okay, so here. There are several law enforcement agencies are not complying with the new law prohibiting the release of mugshots. Some local sheriffs say it's up to them to decide who's right.
It is... Mugshots have met new technology. There are actually firms that gather mugshots and then almost extort you to pay them to take down the picture. Now, having a mugshot is obviously not good to be floating around the web. And having a mugshot doesn't necessarily mean you did anything wrong, right? You can be arrested, they take a shot, and then it turns out you were totally innocent, whatever. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, you have this unflattering photo of you. So I think, yes, we want disclosure, but we don't want an invasion of privacy, especially by some company that's doing it for a profit motive.
But,
so let the local law enforcement agency decide what's in the public interest.
But the newspapers don't like this because basically you're saying to newspapers and other media, you know, we're going to tell you what you can do.
Yeah, the newspaper doesn't like it until the son of the newspaper owner gets pulled over and gets a mugshot and is later acquitted. Then the newspaper owner will like it.
Okay. So, Hudson River cleanup, your administration and the DEC, what will you do if the federal EPA gives GE a certificate of completion for Hudson River cleanup?
We will sue them if there is any legal viability to the suit whatsoever. I'm very afraid of it. This has been going on many years. I believe this federal government is just deaf to environmental concerns. And here's a big corporation, GE, and this is ripe for a Trump doctrine of what's good for business is good for America. The cleanup is not complete, and the Hudson River is a beautiful asset that we must preserve and protect. And if there's any legal ability for us to sue, we will.
There are places that are not giving vaccinations in Hudson Valley, for example. You are where on this one? In other words, our kids are in danger. There's measles outbreaks. There are people who think it's taking away their freedom. What do you make of it?
Look, it's a serious public health concern, but it's also a serious First Amendment issue. And it is going to be a constitutional legal question. Do we have the right, the society, government have the right to say you must vaccinate your child because I'm afraid your child can infect my child, even if you don't want it done and even if it violates your religious beliefs? So that's an issue that's going to be legally questionable, and I'm sure it's going to go down that path.
Representative Espelot came out in favor of granting driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants this week. You say?
I say what I've said. I was Attorney General Elliot Spitzer came out with a proposal. As I'm sure you recall, it created mayhem in the presidential. I said I supported it and I would defend it in the court. I think Speaker Heastie has said that it's an issue that he's going to pursue this session. And I think it's on the short list of open items for the legislature to tackle this session. Driver's licenses, ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, they didn't conclude. I think that's very important in this day and age of assaults on women. Let New York alter its constitution and have an ERA. The Assembly and the Senate have to work that out. Legalization of marijuana, prevailing wage, these are all issues that are on the short list for the rest of session. They're the tough ones, but what I've said to the legislature is I know everybody likes to pass their own bill that's fun and easy, but our job is to do the hard ones, and driver's licenses is a hard one. But I think New York should lead ERA, marijuana, prevailing wage. That's going to be the real test for the new Senate and the Assembly.
Governor, how about Aiden dying? We've just lost a brother-in-law. He went through tremendous pain, wanted out. The law was not on his side to do this. There are many legislators who want it, and you say...
I say pass the bill. It's a controversial issue. It's a difficult issue. But the older we get and the better medicine gets, the more we've seen people suffer for too long. My father started the Death and Dying Commission way ahead of his time, as usual. So it's a difficult issue, but it would need legislation.
And you'd sign it.
It depends on what the bill says. Yeah, but I think it's a situation we have to address, definitely.
Todd Howe sentenced to 5 years of probation last week after cooperating with the government in several corruption trials. You've talked about this as being a great personal hurt to you. I'm wondering whether you have anything to say about what has happened here.
No, I haven't commented on it, and I don't intend to start now. I've stayed away from my commentary on the judicial process, except to say that I was fully supportive and cooperative, and I'm going to keep that position.
So rent control in New York, always a contentious issue. People living in places, you know, that they would have to give up if rent control goes away. And you're saying?
Oh, I left rent control off the short list for the end of session. I'm sorry. We have to make changes, and we have to make changes this year. This system is absurd, and affordable housing is a precious commodity. And this system is just biased and abusive to the tenant. We have to get back to the rationale for these laws. You know, a landlord gets an increase if they make an improvement, major capital improvement or improvement to the unit. All right. But once the landlord is paid back, stop raising the rent. I get a new boiler in the building. Great. I understand I have to pay for the new boiler or my proportionate share. But once the boiler is paid for, stop the increases. So there's a number of reforms that have to be made, and they have to be made this year. We had a Republican Senate that was highly protective of the real estate industry. They are no longer in control, and I think it's an ability to balance the scale in favor of the tenant.
So just to be clear, what you're saying is that this rent control thing has to be reformed to give more of a break to the tenant.
Yes, sir.
Gotcha. We see the whole business of trying to get people into college, kids into college, bribing somebody to help them with that. I know you have daughters, and I know that you would never consider doing something like that, right?
Obviously not. But now that you brought up daughters, so this weekend, two of the daughters come over. Two out of three, which isn't bad. You know, it's hard. I'm at that stage where they're in their 20s. The last thing they want to do is go spend time with dad.
Sure.
But one of my daughters brings over the boyfriend. I call him the boyfriend.
Uh-oh.
I don't like to use names because
Uh-oh.
Names would suggest the permanency. So
Did you grill him?
The boy. Well, this is what I want. I want your unbiased opinion on
sure.
this one. Why would my daughter get defensive, or the boyfriend get defensive,
Uh-oh.
Just because I asked to do a background check?
Sure.
If you have nothing to hide, why do you have a problem with a background check?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
why would you have a problem with fingerprinting? It takes 2 minutes.
That's funny.
It washes right
only,
off.
I can only imagine my telling my daughter Sarah when she was courting, I want to fingerprint the guy. I mean,
what?
Why would he
have a problem unless he has something to hide?
Well, why would anybody do that? I mean, I remember your father telling me once a great story about how old man Rafa and his kids, his boys, grilled him for what seemed like an interminable period, and he wasn't happy about it. Don't you see?
That's true. He did tell that story, and he would say that it scarred him. He loved to use those dramatic, it scarred him forever. That's why I won't do that. No questioning. Just give me the fingerprints.
You're kidding. You're kidding, aren't you? You're obviously joshing me. Your kid comes
I
home.
I tell my daughters, don't you bring home a boy.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you are prepared to have him fingerprinted.
I love it.
Just think about that.
I love it. I love it.
Maybe that's why they don't come over, Alan, come to think of it.
Well, one last thing. Twitter. Everybody's Twittering these days. We got 2 minutes. People of color often don't use Twitter. So are we creating a political messaging system which leaves out people of color?
Oh, I think the Times had a story on this today. We created an echo chamber for the elitists to talk to themselves and this little bubble of an unreal universe that then the political intelligentsia believes is representative of the world. During my primary campaign, the reporter said, oh, you have to watch Twitter. And by the way, I don't look at Twitter. I said, Twitter is a bizarre universe where you all talk to each other. Oh, no, is it Twitter? You see this new movement, blah, blah, blah. I won the primary by a record number of votes. No governor in history got more votes than I did in the primary. Meanwhile, all these reporters are saying, oh, no, you're in trouble because I watch Twitter. It is an elitist bulletin board to talk to each other.
But the president, every time he opens his mouth, it's on Twitter, and that's policy we're talking about, isn't it?
The president has used it brilliantly. It's like throwing a stick and everybody runs to get it. He puts out Twitter. He rallies his base. He has the Democratic Party then spend the day responding to his rant of the day. Meanwhile, then instead of having the Democratic Party actually talk about what they would do and their policies and their belief and their agenda, they spend the day responding, and then cable news goes on and they take the tweet and they're going to respond to the tweet, and he drives the whole dialogue. He's a marketing man, that's what he does, and he is doing it as president, and people are falling for it.
It's always wonderful to have Andrew Cuomo with us. Governor, great fun, and I must say my mood has been elevated since you came on this morning, something that my other colleagues haven't been able to do for me. So thank you very much.
I thought you would go with me on the fingerprinting, and then I was going to use you as a reinforcement.
That's pretty funny. You'll probably make some headlines. Governor, thank you very much.
Feel better. Have a good day.
Bye.